everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Spellman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. It's such a pleasure having you join me today for another in-depth conversation about the subjects and topics that we really must know to empower us so we can make the most informed decisions possible regarding our health and well-being. So we do have another fantastic show, and before we jump into what we need to know about our heart and protecting our heart and having healthy arteries and the real deep truths on those topics, I just want to mention a few things. First of all, if you haven't been listening to my show before, I invite you to go up to my website, whatwomenmustknow.com, opt in there. I have these amazing free special reports on women's health. I have numerous articles and videos. It's a great educational site. And also go over to my Facebook page, like me over there, because I'm always posting great information, sometimes controversial information, leading edge information about things that we need to know for our health and well-being and rejuvenation. So get informed, just stay on the leading edge. That's really where our power is. We really do need to have the knowledge so we can make the best decisions possible. And I also want to announce for all my Down Under listeners, and I know I've got many people down in Australia, New Zealand who listen to this show, I am coming back, so I'm really excited. I'm always thrilled to return to Australia. I'll be down there in June and July, so chance for me to be lecturing around the country again. I've got events in Perth. I've got events in Melbourne, up on the Sunshine Coast in Queensland. So if people listening, oh, and over in New Zealand, of course, in Auckland and maybe other places as well. So if you are listening down under, be sure you are opted into my website, because I'll be sending out further announcements of my trips and locations of where the lectures are and other fun things that I have planned. So it's a chance to meet as many of you as possible when I venture down back into my favorite part of the world. So, okay, let's talk about the subject at hand. We, you know, I believe the statistic is 1 out of 2 Americans will be diagnosed with some form of cardiovascular disease. We know that statins are a major drug that is being prescribed to just about everybody. I mean, my 90-year-old mother was just prescribed statin drugs, and I just want to pull my hair out. But we need to get the truth, and it's a area of great confusion, misunderstanding, and it's time we really set the record straight. So we are going to do that today, and to help us set the record straight, we have a wonderful guest who really is in the know. He is Dr. Joel Kahn. Let me just share a little bit about him. Through over 20 years as a cardiologist, Dr. Joel Kahn has developed a passion for prevention. He calls himself an interpreventional cardiologist. He can perform the surgery that will save a patient's life, but he would prefer to ensure that his surgical service is unnecessary. His practice combines standard Western medicine and its advanced technology with plant-based diets, vitamins, stress management, and exercise. Dr. Kahn is a medical doctor. He is certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine and is subspecialty board in cardiovascular disease and interventional cardiology. He also holds a special certification from the American Society of Nuclear Cardiology and the National Radiation Commission. He serves as a clinical assistant professor of medicine cardiology at Wayne State University School of Medicine since 1993. Dr. Kahn is a fellow of the American College of Cardiology, American College of Physicians, and the Society of Cardiac Angiography and Interventions. He has been a member of the American Heart Association, the National Lipid Association, the American Society of Prevention Cardiology, and the American Society of Hypertension, and the Michigan State and Oakland County Medical Societies. Dr. Kahn is the first doctor in Michigan to be certified by the SHAPE Society, which is Society of Heart Attack Prevention and Eradication. So he has authored over 130 articles on heart disease, over 10 book chapters, and several monographs and video national presentations. He's a frequent lecturer on heart disease and its prevention. He has performed thousands of cardiac catheterizations and stent procedures and has been advising patients on heart-healthy programs for over 20 years. So, Dr. Khan, I guess this qualifies you to talk about cardiology and natural solutions for heart health.
I was just wondering how my mother got on the line because it sounded like her talking, but thank you very much.
I mean, I can just imagine you attending meetings and having to pay for memberships for all these societies and getting, you know, emails galore. It's like you have to clear your inbox all the time, I'm sure.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. It's pretty expensive to keep up to date with everything, but when you're in the Western and the Eastern and the Northern and the Southern worlds of healthcare, you just got to stay in touch with a lot of people.
Battle all those worlds, don't
yeah.
you?
Yes. So I suggest we create an MD-ND program. Just call it MIND or something, because what you train in, I am so respectful of, and it's just, frankly, a little bit disappointing that most of my colleagues, and I don't criticize them for it, just never get exposed to a more thorough systems approach to heart disease, because it's all often one giant body responding to one giant toxic world, and we cardiologists focus just on the heart and do a good job of that, but it's connected to everything.
It's kind of a blinding flash of the obvious, isn't it?
Well, once you get your mind opened, it becomes obvious that poor food, sleep, hormones, diet, stress, you know, it's going to affect more than just the heart. But we divide my world up into all our specialties, and everybody sees six doctors, and it's really one central problem. So
it is a challenge.
So pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's great to have you, because this is such an important topic. As I said, my 90-year-old mother was just put on statins, and you know, I'm pleading with her, and I don't think she's taking them, but you know, she's caught between two worlds too, because it's fear that drives so many people. They're afraid if they don't, they'll get in trouble, and you know, so they know there's risks and side effects. So we'll talk about all this stuff. I want to really start at the beginning, so when we have this conversation, everyone listening can get a really fantastic, solid foundation from which they can make better choices, or the best choices for them anyway. I just have one question to start off with. What was your moment of epiphany that kind of opened you up to understanding the integrative approach that's necessary for our heart health, which is related to everything else health in our body?
Yeah, you know, I there are many people in this field that will talk about their own personal health crisis and or a family member health crisis that caused them to dive into the literature or the alternative world. I don't have such a dramatic story, I'm sorry to tell. I was pleased with the way I was practicing medicine. I've been able to train with some of the best in the country and some of the best centers in the country, but to limit it to that, when, you know, you can't help but know what else is out there and have a little curiosity. And then I just got introduced more formally to some excellent people that were combining university positions and research positions, and were delving into nutrition like that was something that should be surprising, or supplements, or mind-body. So I actually just completed, there's one program at University of South Florida that will train physicians in advanced cardiology in an integrative way, and just actually completed that year, and I'm the first cardiologist, I'm proud to say, in the world to have completely finished that certification. So I've just been hanging around with great people. And, you know, that statement, if you see a bit further, it's because you're standing on the shoulders of giants, is just exactly right for me. Great, great mentors.
Well, that's wonderful to be guided along your path, because it must get you so excited about the possibilities, knowing how the body can heal as we introduce nutrition, lifestyle, detoxification, you know, the whole thing that's required.
It is exciting, and it's I think it both has made my practice, I've been practicing almost 25 years, and I'm more excited, I truly am more excited. I speak to the public all the time. I will speak in high school kids, elementary school kids. There's something to be taught at every level, and now more, I'm a professor at the medical school. I actually give the same lecture to eighth graders I give to medical students, because there's no knowledge in either group. No disrespect to medical students, that's really not on their curriculum to discuss nutrition and inflammation as a root cause of cardiovascular disease. So I actually give the same presentation, I use the exact same slides. So it's made my practice, I think it's easy just to say, more tools in the toolbox. I've got pharmaceuticals, I've got stents, I've got bypass, but now I can talk about stress management and gut health and hidden infections, and really expand the way I take care of people. So it's really, really made it fun. Plus, I think it's hopeful and helpful for patients to hear, you know, diabetes may be reversible if we talk about your lifestyle, and heart disease may actually be reversible if we discuss your lifestyle, and your arthritis may improve with a few simple steps that probably your rheumatologist didn't mention to you. So I don't want to step on toes, but once you've opened that box, it's pretty hard not to share with your patients that there's a world out there that could make them feel better pretty quickly.
Yes, and it's so empowering for people knowing that they can make little changes that can go a big way in their health.
Exactly, and they are frustrated by the medical system quite frequently. So self-knowledge is really key in today's complex world, in the medical world.
Well, good for you for being a pioneer.
Well, you know, maybe. I am working on a book this year. There's a few out there that a patient could pick up by what I hope to call myself a credible person who's not going to throw out all traditional treatment, because God knows we've done a lot of good in the last 25 years with many advances. But we just need to make that horizon broader, and a stent with meditation or a bypass with a plant-based diet or better GI health in a hypertensive patient is just going to make the whole program better. So it's fun.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to look at all those key pieces, or at least as many of them as we can in the time allotted to us. So the way I would like to begin this conversation is to just define cardiovascular disease. Let's just start at that very, very foundational place.
Sure, and maybe we could break it up. There is going to be congenital heart disease, that which you're born with. You can think of a hole in the heart or more complex blue baby stuff. We're not yet in any capacity able to prevent each and every one of those cases. I'm not a pediatric cardiologist, and I really don't have any lifestyle-based medicine comments there. Then we get into more adult-range diseases, and most of those are acquired. Most of that is atherosclerosis, hardening the artery-related cardiac problems. We're not born with clogged arteries. By our late teens, early 20s, we often have some evidence of it if one searches very carefully with sophisticated testing, or if there's been autopsies for people that have died of trauma or something at a young age. So we develop hardening of the arteries, and we now understand that genetics may be a component and lifestyle is the much larger component. And that's probably the largest piece of the pie, and that is, as you mentioned, what will ultimately kill one out of every two people is diseases of that type, heart attacks, angina problems, suddenly dropping dead due to unknown heart blockage problems. I mean, you can include high blood pressure and stroke under the umbrella of cardiovascular disease, and they're very big problems. High blood pressure is the major factor that can lead to stroke. It's not the only one. And as disabling as stroke is, it's still a large problem on the radar map. There's a few others out there, rhythm problems, valve leakage and valve blockage problems. But when we really talk about making some lifestyle changes and grabbing control of your cardiovascular health, we're predominantly talking about keeping your arteries clean, to your brain, to your heart, to your legs, to everywhere that's important.
Okay, so we're talking about healthy arteries. Really, that's the key, because if our arteries get blocked, and we'll talk about what causes that, then it impairs the blood flow, which can damage tissue, muscle, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
Okay, so what is the problem with our arteries? Why are they getting, you know, clogged up, so to speak? I mean, plaque is a symptom, cholesterol, and we really need to go into the cholesterol story, because that is probably the most confusing and probably a big furphy in many ways as well.
Right. So, I mean, the blockage story does center around cholesterol. There's no doubt it's a factor. About one in every 400 or one in every 500 persons has a clear-cut genetic problem. So just think about a graduating high school class, maybe average class. One of those kids might be born, and even at age 18, might already be running a cholesterol of 350 or 330 or 420, which is why it's very important that at least at one visit to a pediatrician before high school graduation, everybody get their cholesterol checked, whether it's at a church or at a doctor's office, to make sure you're not that one in 400, one in 500, where We've seen young people develop blocked arteries. There's even a rarer condition where one in a million has a cholesterol even higher than that, 800, 900. Purely genetic, we gave Nobel Prize awards to the people that figured that out. But that's only 1 in 400, 1 in 500. And since 1 out of every 2 of us is developing blockage, that means that the majority of people are acquiring it for other reasons. And it's very muddied, the role of cholesterol, and we'll expand on that. But diabetes is always going to be mentioned as a disease that promotes arteries blocking. And that's the standard medical question. The way you've been trained and the way I increasingly think is, diabetes is just a word. Why is there diabetes? What is it about the diet, the environment, the stress, the sleep? What medications are they on maybe affecting their blood sugar? And we need to address that. High blood pressure, which is another word that is standard in medicine, may cause arteries to clog up and be damaged. But same question, are there toxins? Are there heavy metals? Is there a diet? Is there sleep and stress that's driving high blood pressure and can be approached along with medical treatment and nutritional treatment? Smoking, we can't end any discussion about blocked arteries without talking about the direct link between all the toxins and all the poisons that come out of regular smoking, and the double or triple the risk of developing blocked arteries. And that really is the major list. Age, because this environment we live in, the more years you're alive during it, the more likely you are to have your arteries blocked. But because of the obesity problem and the diabetes problem, we are seeing people earlier and earlier showing up with heart attacks and strokes. And there's now a whole new field of teenagers with strokes, which is just downright scary.
Wow. So what impairs our arteries? Can we just start, and maybe we can define what an impaired artery is. We'll go back to that eighth grade or your medical school student lecture. So what is it that goes on? Give us a picture of what's happening. Why does that occur in our arteries?
There's this miraculous, and I'll try and keep it simple, but there is this miraculous lining in our arteries. Our arteries are pipes, and there's a single layer of cells that line the inside of our artery. It's called the endothelium, fancy word, the inner tube of the inner tube. And it's a miraculous layer of cells that creates, we now understand, a variety of hormones and other chemicals that keep our arteries from going into spasm or contracting, keep our arteries from developing blood clots and limiting blood flow, keep our arteries from getting plaque so that there's blockage and blood pressure problems. But it's easy to damage the lining of that artery. There probably are some infectious causes. We won't talk more about that. There are some viruses and some bacteria. But it's predominantly things that get in the blood. And what gets in the blood? The major source is things that we're eating that get in our GI tract and enter the bloodstream. So we believe now that inflammation, very, very important concept. Your listeners know that certain foods are inflammatory, set the body on fire. Certain foods are anti-inflammatory, tend to cool down the fire. And those things seem to take the cholesterol that all of us have in our bloodstream, some from diet, most of it made in our liver, and they change the cholesterol and they worsen the cholesterol so it becomes a damaging cholesterol that can then go and affect this inner lining and attack the endothelium. And smoking can do the same thing. It can attack the endothelium. And having a sedentary lifestyle where you never drive your blood pressure up for 20 or 30 minutes of intense exercise may do the same thing. So the first stage of blockage is damage to the endothelium. Very difficult to test for, generally. Actually, for any men that are listening, erectile dysfunction may be a very early clue to endothelial problems. And there's a classic teaching in the last 10, 15 years that a man having bedroom problems might well think about getting his blood sugar, his cholesterol, his blood pressure, his lifestyle evaluated. It may be an early sign to heart disease. No easy equivalent in women. There are some tests for this endothelial function damage, but they're not widely available. They're actually covered by insurance, but you're going to have to search pretty hard to find that. One way is to look for if you're spilling any protein in your urine, maybe a very, very cheap test that tells you if your blood cells are working fine or starting to get damaged. And then the other part of the story besides damages, this inflammation story, and we're learning there's several simple blood tests, but one that's called the C-reactive protein that really is increasingly becoming part of standard physical exams that patients are going to with their primary doctors. So that is how it all starts. We're damaging the inner lining. We're inflaming the cholesterol and damaging it, so it further damages the arteries. And with enough time, the artery will fight to heal itself, and very often the development of the plaque is just the body's normal response to damage, but it's going on day after day after day after day, and ultimately it overdoes the job, and we end up with narrowed arteries.
So the plaque is the body's response to trying to heal this damaging effect in the endothelial cells. So they're getting damaged, and the body is laying down this protective mechanism called plaque.
Yeah, that's well put. It's not all about food, but a lot of chronic vascular disease is about food and smoking. And there's a very interesting body of data now that within 40 minutes after a meal, and maybe for the next 3 or 4 hours, your blood is going to react in either a way that shows that the food was anti-inflammatory, kind of healing, or the food was inflammatory and very damaging. You can have a person eat a standard junk food, fast food restaurant breakfast. I won't name a brand name, but just imagine a sausage patty on a white flour bun with maybe some egg and cheese on it, and everybody knows what I'm referring to. And within 45 minutes of that kind of highly processed, high salt, high fat diet,
and
you can measure in the blood all kinds of chemicals that have been released as if there's an attack on the body. This is your breakfast, but the body views this poor quality food as foreign and dangerous, and all kinds of immunologic mediators in the blood go up, and your arteries constrict. Within 40 minutes of eating a poor quality breakfast of that type, your arteries constrict and stay in that way for about 4 hours. So the body's geared to deal with acute problems. Maybe you got an acute infection, acute sliver, an acute bruise. The body doesn't seem to know what to do when you're attacking it on a daily basis for day after day and month after month. And there is a theory and pretty strong evidence that plaque or blockage is the body's response to this repeated attack on its health and the inner lining of the artery. But it's kind of gone awry because we do it meal after meal after meal, or we don't exercise day after day after day, or we smoke day after day after day, and we're chronically insulting our arteries. And there's only so many ways they can respond to what we're insulting them with, and developing plaque is one of those ways.
Okay, so I think we need to also define terms that are thrown around, and whenever you get your lipid, panel done, you look at HDL and LDL, the good cholesterol and the bad, which I don't think is really an accurate way to describe what those letters are representing. So can you deconstruct this language here?
Well, there was a time, and that time was about 6 months ago, when life seemed simple, and the high-density lipoprotein, HDL, and the low-density lipoprotein are different types that overall make up your overall total cholesterol number. And it seems simple because we used to say the LDL, the low-density L, were lousy. The low-density was bad for you, was lousy. And what we definitely said was the HDL, the high-density, it really just refers to the weight of that cholesterol piece. But the H was H for happy because it was good for you to have a lot of HDL. If you ever wonder how science changes and how much we really are certain about, there's complete confusion right now in the scientific world and the cardiology world exactly what HDL does and what level is optimal, and do we even have a blood test to measure HDL correctly. And you'll hear experts all over the world right now questioning if we should ever really use drugs that are geared for HDL, that we probably don't know enough about how it really works, because we've had two or three drugs that have been studied in the last 5 years that had every feature about them that was going to knock cardiology on its feet and cardiac disease out of the ballpark in terms of preventing it, and it actually showed that they were worse than the placebo. So they did a great job of raising this good cholesterol, except it was very bad for patients. So we're reevaluating that. We've known now for more than 20 years that there's a type of cholesterol called oxidized cholesterol. It's probably the oxidized LDL, probably the most dangerous LDL that does affect this inner lining and the endothelium. I guarantee you not one listener tuned into the show right now has ever gone to their doctor and had an oxidized LDL blood level. Mm-hmm. There are some labs doing it. They're very rare. They're not covered. It's expensive. So really, every cholesterol test we're getting are some kind of approximation of the truth, but I don't think we really know what the truth is, and I don't either. I'm not claiming I know better. I just know that some of the disagreement in the medical community, statins are horrible, statins are good, cholesterol is important, cholesterol is not important, some of it reflects we're really not done understanding this whole process, and we're certainly not done developing the right test to answer the right questions. Certainly for HDL, we are not. So there's plenty of data to say the trend is the higher the cholesterol, the more heart disease. But it may be that you have to have the high cholesterol. Maybe it also has to be this damaged, oxidized cholesterol. And maybe you also have to have this kind of suboptimal lifestyle that causes inflammation. And when you have a few of these together is when your arteries really take a hit.
Okay, so I have another question for you on the LDL category. Small, dense LDL particles, because that's also another area, or that's another term or a finer distinction that's being made that seems to be a real risk factor for these clogged arteries. Do you have any comments to make about small, dense LDL?
Right, and I'll share what I think is the current level of knowledge. I guarantee it'll be different in 5 years. So you can write it down, but leave yourself a space to erase part of it, which is we're explaining now to people that there's a simple concept, that the LDL, the lousy cholesterol type, can circulate in your blood in big, fluffy clumps or little, small, dense, rock-like clumps. And I tell people, based on this concept, if you imagine a tennis net, if you're knocking golf balls, they're going to get through the tennis net. Let's imagine the tennis net is that endothelial inner lining. The golf balls are going to go right through and get across the net. That means the cholesterol is going to get into the wall of the artery and be available to start a plaque and inflammation. Imagine a tennis ball, a light, fluffy ball. That's going to hit the tennis net and not go through, and that are these large, fluffy LDLs. And we have the ability everywhere now to measure if your cholesterol and your LDL is largely the small, dense, or the large, fluffy. We also can measure how many actual pieces, it's called the particle number, of LDL there are. So many of us feel that just the routine doctor's office, hospital, church screening, total cholesterol, LDL, HDL, is, unless it's 350 or 400, when it's risk. That's not something to be ignored. If it's 180 to 250, it may be giving very little difference with that rather wide span or very little predictability if you don't also know the C-reactive protein, if you don't also know the particle number and the particle size, and probably other things that we haven't even yet really figured out yet. So it's not that we're abandoning it, but we're recognizing that it's not a chapter of science that's done and closed. So for your 90-year-old mother, I don't want to be her doctor, but I'd be interested, does she have known blockage? Does she have an elevated C-reactive protein? Does she have a small, dense LDL problem? Does she have a lot of LDL particles? I'd ask about 5 or 6 questions before I'd necessarily take out my statin drug, because it's actually, statins aren't very good at changing small, dense LDL to large, fluffy LDL. Unfortunately or fortunately, it's lifestyle that does that better. It's exercise, it's weight control, it's plant-based Mediterranean-style diets and fish oil and polyphenols and things that are in green vegetables and fruits and nuts and seeds actually do a better job of it. So I'd want to know some of that in the average patient I'm seeing who's in your mother's age range.
Right. And, you know, I mean, just comment that, I mean, because I've looked at her workup, and she doesn't have excessive cholesterol, blood pressure, everything is good, but she did have a blood clot in her thigh. So the cardiologist was able to dissolve that and then just automatically put her on statin.
Right.
But, you know, we can talk about some of the side effects, such as dementia, muscle weakness that's caused from cholesterol drugs. So there's just so many aspects. Well, but I'm going to hold that for a minute because I just want to go back to the small dense LDL. I found it really fascinating because I'm doing a lot of nutrigenomic testing. So
okay.
I'm looking at gene types and predisposed to cardiovascular disease and the gene variant risk that has to do with diet and their lipid profile. And one of the greatest risk factors is the small dense LDL. And I had a conversation with the cardiologist, Dr. William Davis, who wrote the book Wheat Belly.
Yes, I'm friendly with him.
And because he mentioned small dense LDL particles, and he says that number has risen significantly as the intake of carbohydrates have increased, and all gene types across the board do not do well with carbohydrate diets, high carbohydrate diets. So I've just been fascinated with this correlation between the high intake of carbohydrates, the refined carbohydrates, the sugars of all sorts, and its impact on creating or certainly raising the levels of these more dangerous small dense LDL particles.
Yeah.
So do you have any insights into that?
I've not done independent research, and Dr. Davis's book, Wheat Belly, is very interesting, and the history of the production and farming of wheat is a very well-written section. I do sometimes think he lumps carbohydrates as one group that has no subdivisions, and, I mean, all leafy green vegetables and root vegetables and potatoes and yams are carbohydrates, and I'm not ready to give those up as the cause.
No, I think he's talking about the refined.
And the refined. So, you know, we're all, I think, you know, Dr. John McDougall aptly calls what I believe there is right now the diet wars. I mean, I think everybody's in the camp that we shouldn't be lining up at fast food restaurants and gas stations and box stores and eating our breakfast in the car in a white bag and a yellow paper. It's not where health in America is being created. It's where disease is being created. So any processed sugar, carbohydrate, and refined wheat, I think almost all of us are on the same page there. There is no diet war there. He also points out, and I agree with him, there's a much more complex structural nature to the proteins in wheat than there were 100 years ago, and I believe there are many more people sensitive. They may not have celiac disease, but they may be developing an immune response to the wheat that's in most products that we're eating nowadays. It's called triticum, and that lowering the amount of wheat products that we're eating as a country, unfortunately, given the change in the food industry, is a good recommendation. And for some people, going completely gluten-free, not for the majority, but for a good number, is going to help their inflammation. It's going to change their small dense LDLs to a better state. But some of that has not really been tested in a trial that you can conclude. Wheat elimination or reduction versus not, and particle number. Not a lot of data yet. I know Dr. Davis has seen it in his patients, and I have too, but I'm not ready to conclude that chapter's closed scientifically.
No, we wouldn't want you to jump to any conclusions like that right away. We need more time.
Right.
Well, you know what? Speaking of time, we need to take a break. So, Dr. Khan, hang in there. And
okay.
Everyone else listening, we need to take a quick break here. And I want you to know you're listening to What Women Must Know with Dr. Cheryl Selman. So don't go away. We will be right back. Hey, everyone. Welcome back. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know. And today we're talking with Dr. Joel Kahn. He is bridging two worlds, traditional cardiology and holistic approaches to heart health. So we are getting lots of perspectives, which is just a treat, I have to say. So, Dr. Kahn, let's go back to talking about some aspects of the heart. Here's what I want to do in the last half hour of our show. We want to cover a few other key things that relate to health heart challenges, but also I want you to talk about some of your best prevention strategies as well. So we got to fit them in. We want people to be proactive and start doing things. But can we talk a bit about the mitochondria and how the mitochondria, what they are and the role of the mitochondria for our health? I think that's a growing area of interest as well.
Wow, that's really a great question, and we better explain it to the listeners. But so in every cell, but for sure in the heart and in the muscles that make up your legs, your arms, are cells, and in those cells are the powerhouses. And we learn in medical school, like the little batteries, the powerhouses, we call them mitochondria. And in a heart cell, there might be thousands of these little mitochondria. And they are such an amazing, elegant ballet system of producing energy. They produce an energy called ATP. It sounds like STP, but it's ATP in the heart. And you have very limited reserves. The body is there. I think it's about in the heart 10 seconds is all you have stored up of ATP, which means there's these machines that are going 24/7 while you're exercising or while you sleep to produce the energy to cause your heart to beat. If that were to stop, you would stop in 15 seconds or something. So mitochondria. And we know, and I learned this 30 years ago in medical school and then nearly forgot it, all this chemistry and the pathways of how energy is produced and ATP is produced. But we kind of went down all these other paths. I mean, we put in stents like I do and bypasses, and we have pharmaceutical agents, and not one of them is truly geared at optimizing or restoring the way our mitochondria work. We actually know now we can make more mitochondria. It's called mitochondrial biogenesis. We don't talk about that on hospital rounds or grand rounds very often, but there's a resurgence to say we may not always be able to fix a broken heart, some heart attack damage at scar tissue, but we can take each and every one of those cells and we can make the mitochondria healthier. It's always going to go back to a healthy diet, good sleep, some regular exercise, stress management. But we also know that there are supplements. There are actually not really pharmaceutical agents right now. Maybe metformin, a diabetic drug, may do some good things to mitochondria, but we don't use it for that reason. It just may be a side benefit. But otherwise, we're talking about supplements, a supplement called coenzyme Q10, very widely available nowadays. A lot of people have heard of it. We know exactly how it makes a mitochondria work better. There's a supplement called L-carnitine. Every vitamin store is going to have it. And we know how that helps bring a fuel outside the mitochondria into the mitochondria, and how patients with heart disease are often very low on coenzyme Q10. They're low on L-carnitine. We know that there's a sugar you can buy in a health food store called ribose. Tastes great. And we know that that's the backbone of how we make ATP in our body. We know that heart patients are typically low in it, particularly if they're having an angina attack or a congestive heart failure attack. And we know that if we add it to their diet as a supplement in a smoothie, we can boost the blood levels, and actually have shown you can boost the heart levels and the muscle levels. So my practice looks very much at the mitochondria. It turns out it's also important in high blood pressure. It's very important in diabetes, maybe very important in Parkinson's disease and many other conditions. So paying attention to the health of the mitochondria, which is a topic I'm lecturing at my medical school next week, first time that's ever been on the agenda to speak about in a heart conference, is increasingly supported by science and being discussed, but it's still not mainstream. I mean, I consider myself sometimes a mitochondriologist, because that is where the action is. You get a stronger heart if you get healthier mitochondria.
And the muscles have the greatest concentration of mitochondria, like the heart muscle.
They do. The heart has the most of any muscle.
Right.
And the muscle has more than other tissues. But the kidney, the brain, they're all loaded. The Parkinson's disease, the brain cells are loaded with mitochondria, and they're often quite deficient in the part of the brain affected by Parkinson's. And some people respond to coenzyme Q10 and other mitochondrial support supplements.
I mean, I think it's important to mention that CoQ10, which, as you were saying, is a really important nutrient, is depleted from the use of statins. And I think that really needs to be highlighted. So if anyone listening is on a statin drug, one thing for sure they need to be aware of is the absolute necessity to be taking CoQ10 as a supplement.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more that there's a chemical pathway taught in medical school for 3 decades or more that shows when you introduce a statin cholesterol-lowering medication, you will interrupt 5 or 6 steps that lead to lowering your cholesterol. But one of the sidearms is you will lead to lowering your coenzyme Q10 production. And coenzyme Q10, as I just mentioned, is one of those very important supplements for making your mitochondria work at their optimal state. So it may be that some of the fatigue and some of the muscle problems that people experience with a pretty high frequency when they're on statins long-term, cholesterol-lowering medicines like Lipitor and Zocor and Provacol, maybe that it's actually been shown that they lower coenzyme Q10. It may be in part remediable by adding coenzyme Q10 back as a supplement, which is what I do in every single one of my cardiac patients.
Do you have a favorite form of it? Because there are several forms available, and some are better absorbed than others.
Yeah.
What's your favorite?
I'm not yet at a point where I'm recommending one. There's regular coenzyme Q10, and there's lozenges, and there's ubiquinol, which is the reduced version, and there's some data here and there that one's better than the other, but I usually actually measure a blood test, a blood level, because that is one way to know that you're actually getting it into the system, and it's not a very expensive blood test.
Okay. Okay, so let's talk about the role of vitamin D for a healthy heart.
Yeah, boy, you are on top of all the important trends, and very good for your listeners to hear this, because these are simple steps. You mentioned already, you might ask me, but we're talking about them. So vitamin D is both a vitamin and what many of us now are considering a pro-hormone. And it's certainly important in bone health and bone strength, and that's where most people have probably heard about it. But we now know that there's a very strong link between having adequate vitamin D and controlling your blood pressure. There's recently data that adequate vitamin D and controlling your blood sugar. There's increasing data about adequate vitamin D and perhaps Alzheimer's and its prevention, and on and on. And what we're finding, those of us that have been checking vitamin D levels routinely, which for my practice has been about 4 years and thousands of people, is almost everybody's severely deficient. I am in Michigan, but when I talk to colleagues in California and Florida and anywhere, it doesn't matter because everybody's working in jobs where they're dressed up all day and rarely are getting full sun exposure for a big portion of the day. And as soon as we identify it and then supplement it, we're seeing improvements in blood pressure and other measurements. It may also be, and I'm sure you're aware of this data, that some of the environmental toxins, some of the herbicides we walk on the grass and we absorb, our skin absorbs very readily some of these petrochemicals. We're exposed to some solvents, cleaning the house, working in the garage, maybe at our jobs, even our dry cleaning that comes back as a petrochemical-based cleaning process, and we put that shirt on right away or that dress on, and it's against our skin, and our skin absorbs these things even more readily than if we were to take them orally, and that those can affect and create rises in estrogen, our plastics in the environment. All of these may be one of the reasons we're seeing such low vitamin D levels. We're actually having multiple chemicals block what would otherwise be sort of healthy pathways.
Okay, gosh, so much to be aware of. Do you want to also share some of your favorite phytonutrients or vitamins, herbs that you recommend for people to include as a foundational protocol?
Well, sure, and I would always go back to food first and supplements second, but I'm a longtime hardcore vegan cardiologist. And I still take a handful of vitamins because I think the soil is depleted, and I just wonder if my green smoothies are quite as phytonutrient-rich as they might have been 20 years ago. But so going to foods, I have the little mnemonic that I borrow from Dr. Joel Furman when I lecture to the students and the medical students, G-bombs. G, get lots of greens. B, get lots of beans for fiber and protein. O, get lots of onions for sulfur, and you can add garlic right in there as a great sulfur group. M for mushrooms, great regular food, raw or cooked, for immune boosting. It's still season when a lot of people are going around with runny noses, and mushrooms, garlic, onion are excellent natural approaches. B for berries. The report recently that women that regularly eat dark berries, just throw them on your oatmeal, throw them in your smoothie, throw them anywhere you can, have half the heart attack risk over years that women that don't regularly eat dark berries. And then the last, the S, is for seeds and spices, sesame seeds, pumpkin seeds, and the like. And spices are a natural source of antioxidants and anti-inflammation. I I actually teach my patients to get real comfortable with cinnamon, nutmeg, allspice, cloves, powerful, powerful kind of drugs that are called spices, Italian herb spices, oregano, rosemary, great for the brain, great for arthritis, maybe lower the cholesterol, and then kind of the Indian spices, the curry powder, this super spiced turmeric that is like selling out of grocery stores every time it's on the TV shows, and really should. The data is that turmeric and curcumin may lower your cholesterol, your blood pressure, your blood sugar, prevent Alzheimer's, treat arthritis. It's what I tell my patients to take for pain. I tell them, get out your curry powder and your turmeric or buy some curcumin tablets. So that's the natural kind of the G-bombs approach. And in supplements, I think people should be on a base of an excellent multivitamin, and that's usually not the multivitamin that's at their corner grocery store and drugstore. That's usually a natural multivitamin. I would spend a little bit more. I would usually take a multivitamin two or three times a day. If every meal that we eat, unless our diet is really, really at its best, if every meal that we eat causes inflammation and oxidation, then maybe a little boost from a multivitamin twice a day that has antioxidants and anti-inflammatory components might be an excellent choice. So a multivitamin, we talked about vitamin D. We talked about coenzyme Q10 for diabetics and blood pressure patients and cardiac patients and statin patients. And
I like fish oil.
Yeah, fish oil I'm still recommending to most of my patients. It's still on the American Heart screen of recommended items to cardiac patients. I do urge them to look for better quality fish oil supplements at better vitamin shops or online. There's just too much data over too many years, although there have been a couple scientific reviews in the last year that question exactly how effective, but many of us have just seen good effects on triglycerides and weight control and even depression with fish oil, so I'm still there with it, but keeping an open mind. And I'm real big into green supplements. I mean, I know this sounds perhaps strange to some of the listeners, but there's scientific evidence for some of the green powders like chlorella, spirulina, blue-green algae. When I talk, there's evidence. There's evidence that it lowers your blood sugar. There's evidence that it lowers your cholesterol and blood pressure. There's no giant study that yet shows it prevents heart attacks, but these are kind of detoxifying, liver-supporting powders that usually go in my morning smoothie, or you can also buy them as tablets fairly inexpensively. When the radioactive debris came out of the nuclear reactor in Japan, the whole public was given little capsules called chlorella. You can go to any health food store and buy them relatively inexpensively because they're very good for radiation protection and toxin protection. It's one way to kind of optimize your liver to deal with the tough world we live in nowadays.
So, I mean, those are all such basic guidelines, just really eating a nutrient-dense diet, get rid of the junk foods, take some really key supplements. Do you want to say the talk about the impact of sleep? Since there was just a study that came out, I saw it reported maybe 2 weeks ago, maybe less, about how sleep, if you get 6 or less hours of sleep a night, you impair hundreds of your genes.
Yeah, and that was so fascinating, and I'll just comment on that. But there's even a newer one this week I'll tell you about and we'll share with your listeners. But, yes, there's this, I mean, when we talked a while back about hopeful messages for listeners and people with medical illnesses, I mentioned that no matter what gene group you're born with and are carrying as an adult, most of those genes, if they might promote, if you actually were to pay to have them checked and you've got a little higher risk of heart or cancer or Alzheimer's, if you will adopt a lifestyle that's got exercise, doesn't have cigarettes, is an anti-inflammatory, plant-strong diet, you can turn off bad genes, turn on good genes. It works for prostate cancer. There's data now it's working for breast cancer. You eat enough broccoli, you drink enough green tea, you're going to turn off breast cancer genes and improve your odds you'll never get it. Real prevention. And then you just mentioned data a few weeks ago that it was real science that if you sleep 8 hours a day versus 5 hours a day, you can actually within about 3 weeks measure that genes are being turned on and turned off by a good night's sleep versus a short night's sleep. And it goes with the data that chronic short sleep, or unfortunately firemen, policemen, nurses, and others that are rotating on crazy shifts all the time, they may encounter some health problems, and sleep's very potent. There actually is also a report this week, because it is the weekend before daylight saving time jumping forward, that on the Sunday following daylight saving time jump, there's a little bump in heart attacks within one day of losing 1 hour of sleep. It doesn't happen in the fall. It's a springtime event, and it's amazing to really believe that just 1 hour of loss of sleep could cause, you know, 50% more people to show up in the emergency room in your town on Sunday and Monday. That wouldn't happen in the fall, but that's the data. It's been also seen in Sweden. It's been seen this 1 hour of sleep. There's a slightly higher suicide rate for the next few days. And actually, work productivity goes down for the next week. So there are people that argue whatever money we might save at daylight saving time by some less air conditioning and lights that we're running in our house because of longer days and sunnier days, we're losing in the first week because a lot of us just were so close to being chronically fatigued all the time that one extra hour is actually a measurable difference. Hard to believe, but
well,
you know, all over the world, these reports
are
there.
Yeah. So what's the new study that came out this week?
Well, just exactly that, that they looked at over the course of, I think, about 6 years, two major hospitals, happened to be in my hometown in Detroit, and just measured the number of heart attacks per day that were treated for the week before and the week after daylight saving time in the spring and the fall. And the Sunday following spring forward was a bump in heart attacks that was not predicted by chance. It actually was the opposite in the fall. When we get that extra hour of sleep, it actually goes down a little bit, believe it or not. But it was reproducible, and doctors in Sweden reported the same thing about 5 years ago. So now that it's been seen twice, there may be a shred of, you know, real small risk truth to it.
Right. Well, you know, all these lifestyle factors really impact the heart. I wish we had more time because I know you have lots to say about meditation and stress management. Maybe you can just mention that briefly because we are very close to the end of the show, but I think that deserves a mention as well.
Well, again, I thank you for bringing that in. And very briefly, I mean, I wasn't raised around yoga and meditation and prayer and chanting formally, but they're out there, of course. And now there's science. It's not all brand new. I'll just give you one teaser. A large study, about 500 people, published in the United States, researched in the United States. You've had a heart attack, and half of the group, 500 people, half the group get told, eat a healthy diet, exercise, see your doctor. The other half of the group gets told the same thing and gets taught how to meditate twice a day for 20 minutes at a time. At the end of 5 years, the chance of being alive or having your next heart attack drops by 50% if you practice meditation. If you learn to calm down, tune out, quiet down, and stop running around 24/7 like we have created a lifestyle. So it should be something that Medicare and Blue Cross and others look to actually provide reimbursement so large numbers could be exposed to it. But it's not very hard to learn how to meditate online or buy some books and tapes, and I encourage people to begin to explore it.
You know, that's a shocking statistic. That is just better than any drug.
It's better than a drug
can ever take, and it has so many other benefits as well as protecting your heart. Well, let's give people your website. So the best website for you is Dr. J, and I'm going to spell your surname, KAHN.com, correct?
That would be a good place. Just I don't sell anything there, but I do have some books and other resources that people can look at. I'm going to post. I actually just had an article on the web, came out today, about diet for heart patients. I'll be putting that on the website before the night's over. At a website called Mind Body Green, which is a nice wellness-oriented website. But, yeah, I encourage people to take a look there.
Well, that's great. Look, it's been such a pleasure having you on the show. We just have about a minute. Anything you want to just comment on before we have to conclude our
conversation? No, if I had to summarize, and again, I've got good friends that teach me things, and I get the opportunity to share them. I tell people all the time when I'm lecturing and talking and teaching, the three F's, feet, finger, fork. feet, move, move. While we've been doing this interview, I've been walking 1.5 miles an hour on a treadmill desk for the past hour because I could have been sitting in a chair, but I was walking slow. I'm not sweaty, and I've been doing a little work on the side. So move your feet, fingers, don't smoke, and fork. Your fork is a surgical instrument. Use it wisely.
Thank you so much. This has been a great, great conversation. Thank you, Dr. Joel Kahn, for the great work you're doing.
And thank you, too. It's been a total pleasure.
Okay. Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
And to all my listeners, thank you for listening. Again, this is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.